Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The non-AI specified two guests in two segments today. Alex Vitale will talk about Zoran and the cops, and Dwayne Monroe will wax skeptical about AI. These are dark times, but there are flashes of light. One of the brightest is the victory of Zoran Mamdani in the New York City Democratic mayoral primary. He's the favorite to win the general election in November, but everyone from establishment liberals to full-blown reactionaries is mobilizing to crush him. Along those reactionary lines, Fox's Laura Ingraham brought on someone she identified as a survivor of Mao's revolution in China to meditate on Mamdani's mild social democratic agenda. One of the major points of friction with that establishment is what they see as his desire to defund the police, something he never campaigned on, and his desire to replace armed interventions with more humane approaches, which he did campaign on. Here to talk about cops in New York City, and the Mamdani agenda is Alex Vitale. Alex is a professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College and teaches also at the CUNY Graduate Center. His book, The End of Policing, was published by Verso in 2017. Alex Vitale. If you visit New York Postland, which I do probably too often for my own mental health, you learn that the NYPD is shorthanded, underpaid, and suffering an exodus of cops. What's the truth here?
Well, headcounts have fallen somewhat through attrition primarily. Most people serve at most, 20 to 25 years on the job, and many a bit less than that. And so there's always natural attrition. And the only way to make up for that is to have new academy classes. And they have not been having as many academy classes, so the headcount has been falling. During the Bloomberg administration, the headcount fell all but 1 year of his administration. He had planned attrition. He just didn't hire as many police. And every single one of those years, crime continued to fall in New York.
And what about the underpaid and the exodus and all this business? I mean, the Post hasn't all running off to Nassau County or, Houston or wherever.
It's certainly true that the pay can be better out on Long Island relative to New York City. However, those jobs are not nearly as sort of interesting or as prone to overtime as NYPD jobs. So, for instance, we have all these specialized units that create avenues for promotion and overtime pay. So you have to look at the sort of effective pay, not the pay that's like on paper for a particular, year in the contract. So I wouldn't say they're significantly underpaid. And of course, they make more than cops in Houston, but the cost of living is a bit cheaper down there. But I don't think too many people are actually choosing a job in Houston over a job in New York in policing.
And we should underscore the fact that the NYPD is huge, 35,000 people, right? Down from a peak of around 40, but still enormous force.
Yes, and it has per capita many, many more officers than other major cities, almost twice per capita what Los Angeles has.
Okay, and now the surge in crime during the pandemic really disturbed a lot of people, but it's largely reversed itself. Just how serious is crime now in New York City and the rest of the U.S.?
There's a lot of conflating of things when we talk about crime. So for some people, crime, is like the homicide rate or the number of shootings. For other people, it's like a general sense of disorder. But I think it's pretty clear that across the board, we've had pretty significant reductions since the pandemic tailed off. And in most crime categories, we're now back down below pre-pandemic levels, which really were already really historically low levels of crime. We have homicide rates that are 20% of what they were in the late 80s and early 90s.
And we're on track to have the lowest homicide rate in recorded New York City history, right?
And one of the things that's significant about that, beyond, of course, the saving of lives, is that this is one of the most reliable crime statistics because, A, there's a body that has to be accounted for, and B, the coroner's office does its own accounting of homicides, so it's not even completely up to the police department to keep track of those numbers. So when we see consistent reductions in homicide numbers, we know that that's an accurate reflection of what's going on.
You mentioned a sense of disorder. There do seem to be more homeless people, more disturbed people in the streets and on the subway. Some people dismiss these concerns as irrelevant, but it does affect people's perceptions of safety. How important are those perceptions, and how can we deal with them?
They're definitely politically important. You know, I wrote my book, City of Disorder, about Dinkins's failure to address these perceptions and the reality of disorder. I argue it's basically what cost him the election. De Blasio understood this very clearly and really doubled down on things like broken windows policing, not because he thought it was just, but because he thought it would help him to get reelected. We do want to address conditions in the city. It's not that this is all just a political calculation or a question of perceptions. We have near record levels of homelessness. We have large numbers of people who are displaced from the formal economy, who can't get access to basic health care and mental health services. It's a quality of life issue for them as well. And so I think any kind of progressive or radical agenda for urban America has to center on actually addressing the well-being of residents and not just papering it over with aggressive and invasive policing.
Which, of course, dovetails with the rest of Mamdani's agenda. Let's talk about him specifically. First of all, how did he campaign around police issues? Were they an important part of his campaign, and what did he say?
He did not make it a major feature. I think he preferred to try to keep the discussion on his core economic demands. And when the issue came up, he typically said a couple of things. One is he said he wanted to create a new Department of Community Safety that would address a number of both the crime and disorder issues that people are concerned about with mechanisms outside of the criminal legal system. In terms of the NYPD itself, he was the only candidate who did not campaign on hiring more police. But he also said he wasn't going to, quote unquote, defund the police. He was going to basically hold the headcount stable and try to ramp up the civilian-based crime and public safety interventions and create some facts on the ground and then allow us to reevaluate NYPD budgets and headcounts in the future.
Now, as for defunding the police, that's never going to make it into the Hall of Fame of political slogans, is it?
No, I think the right wing was very effective in trying to undermine it because basically there was a disconnect between the discourse of the protests that happened in 2020 and the state of on-the-ground organizing. What we see is this interesting situation where people will say, I'm against defund the police, but I think we should reduce the police budget and spend more money on mental health services.
He's not even proposing to reduce the police budget overall, right? He's just proposing to create this new Department of Community Safety.
But we hear lots of other people saying things like that. So they agree with the core idea of defund the police, but they are eschewing the label.
Okay, this Department of Community Safety. I can already hear the Post. Like I said, I probably spent too much time reading the Post, saying, so you're going to send social workers after people who need a good clubbing. What is the story here?
The proposal as it stands includes five major areas of public safety concern. Hate crimes, subway safety, calls around homelessness, like a homeless person in distress or a homeless person causing some kind of disorder, a mental health crisis response, and community violence, things like shootings. So it really does address a broad range of public safety concerns. Now, the city already has some kind of civilian response for all of these things, but the goal is to try to ramp them up, consolidate them into one place, and really try to carve out, in part, political territory to say policing is not the only mechanism we have for making communities better places.
Zoran also wants to dissolve the Strategic Response Group, whose mission in life seems to be beating up demonstrators. Policing and protests does look to have gotten more severe in recent years, not just in New York City, but around the country. Is that a correct perception? And how can we deal with this in a more humane fashion?
I think it is a correct perception, driven in part by growing political intolerance of dissent. So we can't really understand protest policing as strictly like a technocratic question within police departments. I think every one of your listeners understands that there were political decisions made to try to suppress pro-Palestinian political movements, and protest policing is being used to do that. And we can also see it in the very bald-faced use of federal forces to suppress protests against ICE and the deportation regime. We can't just fix protest policing through some reorganizations within the police department. We have to send some political messages about the use of police to manage dissent. Mamdani would be in a position to do that. And while getting rid of the strategic response group would be a part of that endeavor, it would require a lot more than that. Otherwise, the NYPD will just reproduce it in a new form.
Now, this would be running against the grain of the whole Trump administration's approach to both law and order and dissent and protest.
Well, absolutely. I think this is not just a rebuking of the Trumpist approach, but a rebuking of the mainstream Democratic approach. Big city mayors, and even in so-called sanctuary cities, have used their local police to play a central role in facilitating ICE's actions by using them to suppress demonstrations directly challenging ICE activities.
And what has the relation of the NYPD and the New York City government been to ICE and this deportation agenda?
We have this sanctuary law in New York City, which says that we want to guarantee the ability of people to access schools and hospitals and other public services without worrying about their immigration status. At the same time, the Adams administration has ramped up rhetoric about, well, but we need to get rid of criminal migrants. And so the NYPD is being kind of pulled in two directions here. And while there's a lot of chest thumping about, you know, we don't support Trump's deportation agenda, and the Adams administration does want more cooperation on deporting so-called criminal immigrants, they are the ones often deciding who's a criminal and not a criminal because of things like targeted anti-gang enforcement and quality of life enforcement and things like that.
Speak with the sociologist, Alex Vitale. You mentioned gangs. That was my next question, actually. It sounds good. I mean, no one likes criminal gangs. So what is the nature of the approach to gangs now, and how would Zoran change that?
It's a complicated issue, in part because nobody can give you a clear definition of what a gang is. If we see a group of people working together to commit extortion and to coerce people into sex work and deal drugs, you know, we have a sense, that's a criminal enterprise that produces a lot of bad things for our communities. But what we've also found is six kids who walk to school together from a low-income public housing project and like the same music and give themselves a name for their group and occasionally get into a fight on a playground are also being labeled a gang. We really need to question this use of the gang label because it is a politically motivated decision to use that label. Yes, there's violence in the community. It's at historic lows, but we still want to try to do everything we can to keep it going down. The decision to call it gang-related means that then the solution becomes gang suppression policing, when just as easily the city could say, hey, this is a problem of youth violence driven by trauma and deprivation and social dislocation, and we could try to invest in strategies to address those problems that lift kids up, that repair past harms, that address past traumas, instead of producing more trauma and more harm through the
You study cops. You spend a lot of time talking to them and thinking about them. How many of them, from the street level all the way up to the senior level, how many of them think about how what they're doing is really trying to deal with the effects of serious social problems? Do they really understand the context in which crime arises?
I think a lot of them do have some sympathy for this. They see on the front lines the pointlessness of, like, moving homeless people from one subway station to the next, from one street corner to the next, from one encampment to the next. They see that that is not a solution to homelessness, and it's not even a real solution to communities' concerns about disorder and crime. We know that rank-and-file police don't want to be involved in, like, mental health crisis response. That is not the job they signed up for. It involves a completely different and even contrary skill set, and it leads to lots of bad outcomes. We have polling data nationally that shows even a majority of Republicans think somebody other than police ought to be responding to someone having a mental health.
Cops are always going to misbehave. They're always going to do excessive violence or do corruption. Now, you urge Mamdani to reject a bad apples approach to this misbehavior. What do you mean, and what's an alternative to that?
We've gotten into this habit of viewing police misconduct through the lens of individual level culpability. And this is true whether or not you're a community advocate who is concerned about, you know, police misconduct, or even within the police department. The whole discourse comes down to, you know, do we have the legal basis to either take administrative action or criminal action against this police officer? And all of this is rooted in a very simplistic idea of using punishment as a deterrent to try to change what are, in essence, deeply structural and institutional behavior patterns. Even when we see an officer convicted of a crime, like we saw in Minneapolis, like we've seen in Chicago, where is the evidence that this actually changes how the police do their job? In fact, there is no such evidence. These individualized prosecutions do not change the way police do their job, because police are doing the job the way political leaders want it done. So the individual level impunity of police is a structural feature of policing. It is not a bug. What I've proposed is that we look to a structural level intervention, so-called sentinel event reviews. These are what are used when there's an airline crash, for instance, or a death in a hospital and under unusual circumstances. And the goal of these sentinel reviews is not to focus on individual culpability, but to try to figure out, A, what happened? B, why did it happen? And C, how can we prevent this from happening in the future, right? We don't want any more plane crashes. Now, that could involve a change of procedure, or it could involve a change of technology in the case of, like, airplane crashes. But I think when it comes to policing, what it often involves is some questioning of why we were even using police in this circumstance in the first place. For instance, between a quarter and a half of all people killed by police in the United States are having a mental health crisis. And the way to reverse those numbers is not to raise legal questions about the use of force by officers. It's to quit sending police on these calls.
Mamdani has said he'll keep Jessica Tisch, whose qualification seems to be that she's from a family of billionaires, on as commissioner. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't think he said that he would. I think he said he was open to it, and we heard that from some of the other candidates. I think it's not a great idea, not because she's not capable of managing the department, but that she is almost by nature not an ally of the mayor. And the police department is such a potentially powerful force that can be used to undermine his overall agenda that I feel like he really needs someone loyal to his broader agenda in that position to try to help, if nothing else, neutralize some of the institutional pushback against him on a broad front. It's clear that Tisch shares a police-centered worldview. She wants to ramp up deportations of so-called criminal immigrants. She's doubling down on so-called broken windows policing that criminalizes the poor. She's in favor of more intensive anti-gang policing. She's a big fan of the strategic response group. You know, she does not share the Mamdani agenda, and I think very quickly would be aligned with people working to undermine it.
Now, we've seen lots of revelations of corruption in Adams' NYPD, including a suit from a fired commissioner who's calling it essentially a gangster operation. How deep is this problem, and how long has it been so? Has it gotten worse under Adams, or has this always been like this?
I think it's clearly gotten much worse under Adams. He installed a kind of hand-picked team of his cronies to help him actually be the shadow police commissioner and try to manage day-to-day affairs from the mayor's office. Once you unleash that kind of political corruption, very quickly we find that people are selling jobs, giving benefits to friends. There's just a new revelation today that someone making over $100,000 a year was told they didn't have to come to work anymore. They had this legitimate health issue with a family member, but they should have taken family medical leave, not being given a six-figure no-show job as a political favor. So I think we're going to see more revelations of this kind, more whistleblowers coming forward, and I think it just shows that Adams is not qualified to be police commissioner, much less mayor.
Yeah, qualified to be much of anything, except a stand-up comedian. He can be good at that sometimes. Have you talked with Zoran Mamdani? Is he listening to advice like yours?
So I played some role in the drafting of the Department of Community Safety proposal, and I did speak with him during the campaign, but he's in Africa. I haven't spoken with him since the campaign. I noticed that the campaign manager, Elle, has moved into a purely policy position, which I think is a good sign, and that the people with more mainstream political experience are being used in the campaign side to manage this huge operation that's going to be necessary to win in the general election. But we don't see him bringing in what I would view as problematic policy people.
He might get some criticism the left for not being enough of a defunder and an abolitionist. Do you see any problems for him coming in from that sphere?
I'm sure there are people who would like to see more dramatic action taken, but he has signaled pretty consistently what we can expect of him, and I think that's really important. In the long run, I would, of course, love to see more scaling back of the police department through attrition and using some of those savings to invest in more community-centered interventions. But I think the most important thing right now is to get some of these alternative interventions ramped up, to create some facts on the ground, to create some community goodwill as a long-term investment in creating real community-centered safety.
Finally, a big political question. What about the political power of cops? We have civilian control of the military, but we don't have it of cops. What is the root of their power, and how could it be challenged? You know, we saw outright insolence coming from the cops under Dinkins and de Blasio, probably more intense directed against Mamdani. How can this be dealt with?
Well, they are very large, well-funded unions that represent the different aspects of these institutions. We saw them uniformly, so to speak, get behind Adams, which is interesting. They will work to undermine his agenda, especially to the extent that he feels that Mamdani is challenging their wages and working conditions. And that was, of course, the root of a lot of the anger towards de Blasio, was that it was masquerading as like opposition to Black Lives Matter kind of rhetoric, but it was also because they were in the middle of labor negotiations. And so how Mamdani handles labor negotiations will be important. The fact that if he were to switch to more of a sentinel event review approach, there would be less confrontation around the disciplining of individual officers, which is a big concern of these unions. And then for the institution of policing itself, you know, having a loyal commissioner is important. And also, I think, dramatically scaling back their internal public relations office. That is a huge operation that plays a big role in shaping media narratives about public safety, and Mamdani needs to take more direct control over that narrative by having that messaging coming from the mayor's office and having it be about more than just the police.
That was Alex Vitale, a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and author of The End of Policing. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of No More Cops by MDC. No more rent, no more deeds, no more money, no more greed, no more hate, no more fear, no one unhappy, no one sad. Okay. Next, the ominous topic of artificial intelligence, featuring our AI correspondent Dwayne Monroe. A wild and momentous moment. As I was preparing today's show, I got a bulletin from Bloomberg informing me that Microsoft's stock had surpassed $4 trillion in market value, following the path of chipmaker NVIDIA, which hit that milestone a couple of weeks ago. The Microsoft surge was powered in part, somewhat irrelevantly, by a strong profits report from Meta, whose stock, sadly, is languishing just below $2 trillion in market value. All this has only accelerated the AI bubble. That bubble is happening in the financial markets, but also in the capital spending decisions of major players like Amazon, Meta, the parent of Facebook and Instagram, and Microsoft. Bloomberg Businessweek summarized some recent developments in a Thursday email. Whether all this is paying off in revenue or profit is anybody's guess. Some of these companies, including Amazon and Meta, are still early in figuring out how to make money from AI. Even Microsoft, whose business model for AI is further baked, reports its AI revenue and profit in a way that can't be easily compared with previous periods. When it does provide financial disclosures of AI, they're sporadic and perhaps only shared when the data is favorable. That's the end of the quote from Bloomberg Businessweek. Spoil sports that we are here in Behind the News, this is a perfect setup for the next segment, a severely skeptical look at AI. It's been over a year since we had Dwayne Monroe, a rare dissenting voice against a brigade of cheerleaders, on to wax critical about the thing. He's an Amsterdam-based software engineer who has a side gig doing Marxist analyses of the tech industry, based on his decades of experience in the biz. Dwayne Monroe. Now, it's been a while since we talked, but reading the news, you'd think AI is going from strength to strength, proving all the skeptics like us wrong, approaching the holy grail of general intelligence, and threatening to destroy millions of jobs along the way. So give us, to start with, an evaluation of these grand claims, which just get grander by the day, it seems.
Isn't it interesting that they get grander and grander? What's happening is that the industry is desperate for growth. One of the things that people don't talk about when they talk about this industry is the business. Like when many academics who are camp followers of the technology and talk about how transformative it allegedly is, when they talk about it, they almost never talk about the dollars and cents of it, the investor class, what they expect. Microsoft, and I lead with them, not only because that's the firm that I have the most experience with directly, over decades, but also because I think Microsoft is an exemplar of what's going on. Microsoft has invested many, many, many billions of dollars in OpenAI, and they made a bet. And their bet was that, you know what, we will build the data centers, we will operate the data centers, we will invest in this firm, and people will come running. But the problem is that there's no use case for these things. Yes, people will say, hey, you know what, I used it to, you know, summarize text or generate a few ideas. That is not a sufficiently large-scale use case to support a hundreds of billions of dollar investment in data centers that have to be maintained because they don't last forever, personnel, energy costs, all of it. So the reason for these lies, and they're just plainly lies, that we're building this, we're building that, it's intelligent, please replace all your workers with it, is that they are desperate for customers to actually sign on the dotted line and spend millions. And it's not happening. Customers have been signing up, some early adopters, like using, for example, a platform that Salesforce has called Agentforce that's supposed to allow you to replace like workers, let's say, in the call center. And it just doesn't work. Even Salesforce's CEO has admitted that it doesn't work, but he's going to charge more for it anyway. So that's why they're making these outsized claims. They're just running around like chickens with their heads cut off, trying to find customers and ways to get this money back.
It seems quite the financial bubble. The big guys like Microsoft and Meta are buying gobs of NVIDIA chips,
yes,
which has been very good for the company's profits, and also the stock prices of all these big actors. Bubbles are often froth on top of real things, and sometimes they're just mass delusions that burst, leaving nothing behind. I'm guessing you're leaning towards the mass delusion that will burst, leaving nothing behind.
Yeah, I mean, it'll leave something behind, which is infrastructure that can be repurposed. You can certainly use the data centers and chips for other things, although as long as they are controlled by corporations, they won't have a chance to do that. They'd probably rather write it off than surrender it.
They're spending huge wads of money. I mean, the numbers are phenomenal.
This is where the madness comes in. Those of us who, you know, are familiar with how businesses function know about the sunk cost fallacy, right?
Finance 101.
Precisely. I've experienced this in corporations in which I was on a project in which they spent $8 million initially. It did not produce the results that they wanted. They spent another $10 million. Until the vice president was fired, right? After blowing 2 years and a lot of money, almost $20 million, which is peanuts compared to what these guys are doing. There's also personal reputations at stake. Satya Nadella, CEO of Microsoft, who was hailed as a hero not that long ago, because, you know, Satya took over the company after Steve Ballmer was in charge and pivoted the company decisively to cloud, as we call it. And that was a success. And then he decided to pivot the company decisively to AI. His personal reputation is on the line. He would never be poor, you know, he'd cash out, but his reputation is on the line. And so he has been forcing the company to twist itself in the knots. I mean, Doug, I can tell you that Microsoft customers are complaining about a degradation of service. And the reason why this is happening is because the company is eating itself to try to justify this cost. And that's because of executive decisions, again, sunk cost, in which they're saying, if we just keep pouring more money into this barrel of fire, something will eventually happen.
I think a lot of people will say, oh, you're just being impatient. This is going to take time. The payoff is somewhere down the road. How far down the road are we thinking of?
Well, that's the thing, is that boosters will say, we'll just give it time. Well, we've had years now in which there's been no use case. To give you an example, like a real world example, a database, which is a classic bit of technology that allows you to store information, retrieve information in a structured way. Everybody has a use for a database. An Excel spreadsheet, which everyone is, if you're not familiar with, like, you know, enterprise scale databases, you are familiar with a spreadsheet, which is a kind of a simple form of database. Everyone finds a use for a spreadsheet. Everyone finds a use for a database. No one has found an actual use for chatbots.
Well, companies are using them as customer service agents, and they're just frustrating and useless.
Exactly.
And make you want to go out and commit homicide.
That's precisely right. And there's an angle to this that people are missing, because a company will say, hey, you know what? We replaced 100%, 50%, whatever, of our customer service people. And you are correct. The customer service is touted as like a success story. Companies will say, hey, we replaced all these workers with AI. And then the news or media says, you know, ah, look, AI is growing. But then what's actually happening is that the customer service experience has been damaged or perhaps even removed, because the whole point of it, at least from our perspective as people who buy things, the whole point of it is that, hey, I have a problem and I need the problem solved. But that's not the company's concern. The company's concern is just, you know, saying that they offer customer service, but using chatbots, just as with phone trees from a decade or more ago, you get caught in a loop and you're not getting any service really. So AI is not replacing the job. AI is destroying the labor that used to be employed for the job.
I've seen some studies, I don't think there have been too many of these, but I've seen some that look at actual corporate uses of AI, and they're finding nobody's making any money in this stuff.
That's exactly right. And I'm on LinkedIn for professional reasons, right? And I have noticed a turning of the tide on that platform. You know, any platform can be used to gather real intelligence. I mean, yes, you know, it's ridiculous, just as Twitter is ridiculous. I'm not going to call it X, you know, the hell with that. But if you read it carefully and note the signals, you can see trends. So, for example, on LinkedIn, many of the people who not that long ago were just yelling and screaming about, you'd better get your business into AI or else you're going to lose all your money. Now, because more and more corporations are saying, well, okay, we spent X amount of capital on these proofs of concept and nothing worked, or maybe it worked 20% of the time, and that's no good. So now some of these same people are starting to say, hey, you know what, you need to be careful, or here's the actual way you should use it, or some are even going so far as to just abandon the idea altogether, because if you're a grifter, say on LinkedIn, you want to go where you think the customer wants you to be to sell your service. If you have a real service, it's not a problem because you say, hey, you know, here's a service, and people go, that's a good idea, thanks. But if you're a grifter, and almost everybody in this so-called AI space is a grifter, then you have to continually change your story. And this is what I'm seeing, that now people are changing their story because I don't know when this bubble will burst or if they'll just keep pouring capital into it because the tech industry has nothing else to do right now. But at some point, it will collapse. These LinkedIn grifters don't want to be left holding the bag in terms of their attempts to fool you.
People use the terms large language models and AI as pretty much synonymous. Are they actually synonymous and does it matter?
It does matter because large language models are a particular method within the overall what used to be a research program in the 1950s and 60s and so forth. There was a research program called artificial intelligence, which was considered accurately aspirational, not something that had been achieved, but aspirational. People like Marvin Minsky, for example, and others, you know, were doing research programs in universities and governments were spending money. Large language models are a particular type of method for doing algorithmic manipulation of data. And in the case of large language models, it's what's called the tokenization of words and symbols. And by tokenization, I mean, let's say you have the word cat. Well, a computer doesn't know what a cat is, but what you can do, because software is symbol manipulation, you can create a corresponding symbol within a data set or within software that says, whenever you encounter cat, this is the symbol you should use. And then you can build a probability method because, you know, we tend to use language in certain ways. And so that's why these models, and they're called large language models because they are indeed large. That's why you have these massive data centers. Because you can have a language model that can just run on your laptop. You know, it's not large, but it's a language model. But the large language models, they crunch the numbers. That is to say, they ingest data. That's why the stealing is so key. Because in order to make the output as plausible as possible, the models need millions upon millions upon millions of examples of text, in the case of text, and images now, because with the so-called generative AI, it's the same principle, just applied to imagery. You are correct that the industry, because that's the only thing that they have that's working, and by working, I mean at least it can produce plausible text output, right? Because that's all they have been promoting the idea that large language models equal the entire field.
We've got like four or five giant companies pursuing the large language model dream. Are they all doing basically the same thing, or is this an instance of competition encouraging innovation?
Yes, they will tell you. I mean, there's tweaks, there's different mathematical methodologies. You hire different groups of talented people who come up with clever modifications, clever variations, but it's all the same thing. You have a Ford and you have a BMW. I mean, okay, there's differences, but they're both cars.
I'm speaking with the software engineer, Dwayne Monroe. Now, we should talk about the dark side of this, the effect on the culture. I saw this guy on Twitter, I still call it Twitter like you, the other day, who is arguing that you don't really need to read The Wealth of Nations. You can spend an hour with ChatGPT and find out everything that's important about that. And I think, my God, we've just entered full post-literacy. The complexity of an important importance of a text like The Wealth of Nations. That's a book that should be read. To think that you're getting the same experience by just querying ChatGPT is stupid and frightening. But you're also seeing the same thing happening with students who are not learning how to write. I always quote Emerson saying, I'm always wiser when I put down my pen than when I pick it up. That experience is being lost as well. So this, the effects of this on our culture, which already has enough troubles as it is, aren't going to be dire.
One of my pastimes is watching old atomic test films. And the reason is because what's communicated in these 1950s and right about to the mid-60s, because the tone of them changes as we get into the 70s. But certainly in the 1950s, there is an aura of technical competence that was communicated in the United States in the post-World War II era. And those of us who are familiar with Cold War history know that a lot of this had to do with, of course, competition with the Soviet Union and wanting not to be left behind and all of that. But I think now that what we have come to realize, none of us expected to see this in our lifetime, is that the United States, that was a period of time in which the technocratic segment of U.S. culture that grew up in the 20th century had a hold. But this is against, I think, the natural grain of the United States. Anyone who knows the history of this country knows that it's basically a history of violence, yokelism, extreme racism, genocide, and an aggressive stupidity. It's not new. And
American Protestantism is all about distrusting the knowledge of the head, you know, and all that business. And now we're seeing it in the Trump administration race to national policy.
Exactly, exactly. One of the triumphs of Trumpism is a triumph of that large, large portion of that aspect of American culture that hates knowledge, really.
The same guy who was saying we don't need to read The Wealth of Nations was also saying there's no great American literature. And as someone who spent some years studying American literature, there's an awful lot of great stuff.
There's another aspect to this that I think surprised people. It didn't surprise me because I've worked with these people for decades, but I think it surprised a lot of people outside of the tech industry who assumed, and also this is because of the propaganda of U.S. culture about this and global culture, certainly in the West, that tech people are smart. By smart, which is a kind of a general term that, you understand software, therefore you must also understand other things. By the way, some of these people don't even really understand software, just kind of pretending. But there was an assumption that Silicon Valley was a center of, you know, knowledge, indeed maybe even wisdom. Jobs was brilliant at sales, and he was brilliant at presenting himself as a guru. And so when I started my career, Doug, it was not uncommon for people to refer to me in my role as a guru. Like, this was the kind of thing that people were talking about, you know, that, you work with this technology and that makes you brilliant. And no, it does not. The people in this industry are often Philistines. And so what they have because of this plausible text machine, the plausible image generating machine, is that their full hatred of the arts. And I will tell you, I'm not exaggerating. As I say, I've been around these people for a long time. And of course, I'm not saying everyone who works with this technology. I mean, obviously, I do, and I don't hate the arts. But at the elite level, there is, at the very least, a disdain for other forms of knowledge. I got into a conversation with a techie not too long ago who kept insisting that large language models were more important and more complicated than a thermonuclear bomb, or indeed the sun itself, right? And that's the kind of people, that's the mindset that we're dealing with, is that their vainglory, their sense of self-regard is so outsized. And this is also mixed in, I must say, with ideas of white supremacy and patriarchy, because these people will consider themselves like, you know, I'm a man, and it's all mixed in there. So there's this goulash of American anti-intellectualism meeting what I would call the end stage of American technocratic competency, because you can't continue like this for another generation, because you won't even be able to build a data center if you keep up this way.
It's fascinating to watch so many of these big guys like Andreessen and Sachs, Musk for a little while, all gravitate to Trump, who is just the most ignorant, crude character you could imagine. And, you know, also you mentioned the white supremacy. I mean, that's really visible in this South African flavor of some of these characters, too. It's just really an amazing coincidence now of Trumpism and this, you know, AI worship tech is.
Yeah, and it is a coincidence, but I think also there's a valence. Because if you dislike pointy heads who read, then a machine that spits out plausible text is perfect for you. Because in the past, before you had such a machine, if someone said, oh, the Wealth of Nations, you know, then you'd have to defer. Either you'd be silent or you dismiss it, which was obviously, you know, people outside of you would say, well, that's pretty stupid. Why are you dismissing it? Or you would attempt to read it. But now, through these, you know, generated summaries, they can pretend that they know. And people used to say this about Wikipedia, right? I remember years ago, people would say, oh, you know, Wikipedia is for dummies or so forth. And I would always push back because I would say, if I read a Wikipedia article on, continuing with the atomic theme, nuclear fusion, it will give me a good overview of the current state of knowledge, but then it will do something very important. It will point me to original sources. So I can then read for myself what scientists and researchers are doing, which of course these summaries often don't do, or even if they do, people then assume that the summary is all you need. And so they don't actually acquire any real understanding, but they can pretend to in a way that's even worse than what people used to do with Wikipedia.
Yeah, as a friend of mine once said, we all just remember the equivalent of an encyclopedia article, but to do that, you need to read the real original text.
Precisely. And then the beauty of the reading, of course, of the original is that, I mean, I have many books that, I mean, I've read, but I don't necessarily reread the entire book, but I'll reread a key chapter to remind myself of what it was about the book that grabbed me. Like, ah, yes, exactly. You know, I read this 10 years ago, but now I understand.
Just to get corporate again, Apple has been getting bad reviews in the tech press and on Wall Street for having missed out in AI. Meta has hired away 4 top AI engineers just in the last few weeks. Apple did publish a research paper in June with the phrase, "the illusion of thinking" in the title, which is interesting not just in itself, but as a window into what this very secretive company is up to. If this all turns out to be a grand illusion, will Apple end up looking sensible? That it kept its head while all about them, others were losing theirs?
Neither one of us has insider insight. However, reading the tea leaves, and this paper that you mentioned is quite interesting because I've read it several times, kind of a brief overview of this paper. So in the world of LLMs, large language models run by corporations, typically, like Google will do this often, Microsoft will do this, OpenAI certainly, we ran it against benchmarks. And thanks to these benchmarks, we know that, you know, our model is as smart as a toddler or as smart as a graduate student. And they base this on prompting the model using a text from tests, like let's say GSAT or something like that, you know, some benchmark, you know, based upon testing. And then say, oh, well, if now the language model can be a lawyer because it passed the bar, like this kind of thing, right, by feeding it questions. What Apple did, which was very, very clever, was they said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to create a prompting engine that will vary the prompts so that, and just keep at it, just keep prompting again and again and again. They call it the GSM. And it just prompts the models to see if they can be consistent. Now, if you ask me 10 times what's the capital of the Netherlands, I will say Amsterdam over and over and over again because I know it. Whereas what Apple found was that by doing, and they focused on so-called mathematical reasoning, or rather models that companies that own them claim were doing mathematical reasoning. And they found that by simply prompting, by simply making variations on the prompt, that the answers got wrong. Because the models don't reason, they were simply responding. And even when they appear to reason, the paper tells us, it was because the chain of reasoning was actually in the training data. And so the model just picked up on the text and then found an example of a chain of reasoning and then would respond to the prompt with what appeared to be a chain of reasoning, but was actually taken from the text that was inputted into it. So that when you kept pressing them over and over and over again, and doing a variation of your prompt, then the models fall apart because they can't reason. Because you could say, the Netherlands, what's the capital of it? And I would say Amsterdam. Like, it doesn't matter how you vary that as long as the information is conveyed. You could even make a mistake in the name of the Netherlands. You could say, you know, now it's called the Netherlands. You could say, well, Holland, what's the capital of that? I said, well, it's really called the Netherlands altogether, and, you know, but the capital of the country as a whole is Amsterdam. Models can't do this because they can't reason. And that was the point of the Apple paper. And I think that Apple, behind the scenes, realizes that this is going to fall apart. And we don't want to be caught with our pants down. they tried Apple Silicon, and no one liked it. It was not successful at all. They tried Apple Lens, which had these, you know, some elements of facial recognition and object recognition, and it wasn't successful. It was too expensive, and people didn't like it.
Yeah, Photos recognizes my breed of cat.
Yeah. Well, to the extent that it's successful, it's because of the millions and millions and millions of examples that have been fed to it. But if you could do a simple variation on the photo, and it would say something else. Whereas, you know, you could show either one of us. You could put a hat on your cat, and we don't need to see training data. We said, okay, well, that's a kitty. So I think Apple is positioning itself to do the opposite of what Microsoft is doing.
Finally, what does the future look like? More big claims a la Elon Musk and self-driving and a little in the way of real success? When will the illusion finally lift?
I don't know, because they, you know, as I say, the industry, and let me be clear so for people to understand what I mean. Of course, it's profitable. Of course, they have products that people want and indeed need, like corporations need databases, as I mentioned earlier. They need email service. They need things like this, you know, to run in a modern world. The problem is not that they aren't profitable selling these classic products. The problem is that they want growth, which, as we know, capitalism demands, right? And they can't figure out how to achieve that growth with their existing product set. So we can't predict the future, but I feel that at some point, the investor class will say, okay, enough is enough. And what we will see is, as we did with the metaverse, and as we've seen with blockchain, not so much crypto, because crypto is useful for them to find a greater fool. But I think the investor class will quietly pull out. And then the data centers will either close or they'll be reduced in size. And there'll be a lot of unused computational capacity.
And a lot of ecological damage from using it.
And a great deal of ecological damage, yes.
Now, as a software engineer, Dwayne Monroe, I'm recording this as New York City passes through yet another flash flood-inducing downpour. It never just rains anymore, it floods. Maybe AI could solve the climate problem it's only making worse. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Told Myself, just off from the Australian musician DJ Logic 1000, the nom de deck of Samantha Poulter. The vocals are by Amira El Shafi. Till next week, bye.
I told myself that I wouldn't get it right.